Okay, so what I would like to do is to tell you about some recent and some not so recent results we have obtained on whole oak mock insulators. And just give our motivation for considering this problem. Then I'll talk about mock insulators at hard filling and mock insulators at finite doping. This is something that I think is not so well known, although some people do it for quite some time. Then I'll turn to the main part of the talk, concentrating on the spin dynamics in photo mock insulators, considering the TJ model. We read the TJ model in dynamical Newton theory in order to capture the expansion direction. We use extended dynamical mean field theory, which leads to a mapping onto an impurity model with fermionic and bosonic parts. We solve this impurity model approximately by a generalized non-crossing approximation, and also by some results on a cluster extension of this calculation. And the results are, I think, quite interesting. Namely, it turns out that in this approximation, one finds pseudogaps in the single particle spectra and in the spin spectra. One finds a violation of Luckinger's theorem at not too large doping, so doping is less than approximately 0.15. We find that the entropy is suppressed in the underdoped regime, and define transport properties which are somewhat reminiscent of those observed in the Cooke rates. And so since all this comes out in a situation where the spin fluctuations are so strong that all the spectral features are totally broad, we have called this an incoherent metal phase. Whether it's a phase really or it's just a crossover, that's of course a matter of semantics.
Does transport reminiscent of the Cooke rates mean linear in T?
It means that the resistivity is linear in T. It means that the resistivity in the pseudogap regime turns down. The whole constant is positive in the underdoped regime. And it has the correct dependence on delta, on the doping, one over delta, and roughly correct compression dependence. So I'll show it. Okay, so what is the motivation? Of course, the motivation for at least the main part of the TJ model is coming from the physics of the Cooke rates, where we have the well-known phase diagram, which is T versus hole doping. We have an anti-ferromagnetic regime here. We have the superconducting dome here. And we have the pseudogap phase here, strange metal phase here, and there's some semi-liquid phase for larger dopings. And it's clear that in these regimes, strange metal and pseudogap regime, there are very strong fluctuations. So we have strong fluctuations in spin variables, in charge, Cooper pairs, maybe some others. And the question is how to deal with this situation. Now you could imagine that there are various possibilities. A quasi-particle description, for instance. Is it still possible? Well, it might be that we still have a thermoliquid situation, but it's strongly modified.
Oh, I wonder if it's
with corresponding effective interactions. Of course, it also might be that we have new quasi particles, or even model quasi particles, that have been proposed early on, spinons and holons. Other particles, fractional statistics, or that's the alternative you would like to consider. We have a situation where there are no well-defined quasi-particles. But only incoherent, highly incoherent excitations. And that's the possibility we would like to consider here in this model calculation. And it turns out that, as I mentioned before, there are a lot of properties that come out of this calculation that are shared by the experimental observations on the couplets.
Do you think that it would be possible by some ingenious transformation to actually come up with some new quasi particles, which would be again well defined particles in the sense of a thermoliquid description, and that the problem is just that we use the wrong starting point for that? I mean, so do you think that no matter what kind of basis you would use, we would always end up with incoherent quasi particles or no quasi particles? This is just a problem with the terminology.
Wait. I mean, this is, of course, a question that is probably cannot even be decided, because as long as you haven't found these quasi particles, it's always possible that they exist. So I would not exclude that, certainly not.
Starting from this basis, you have incoherent.
That's right. That's what I want to say. Right. And, well, I mean, and then you have to ask, well, of course, I mean, I think quasi-particles we like to call structures that can be seen in experiments. So you should have at least some experiments so you can see some signature of quasi-particles. Okay, so that doesn't seem to be the case. So let me now turn to the first part. That's more a, well, I would say, side remark. Mott-Hubbard insulator. Yeah, the as you know, the standard model to describe this is the Hubbard model. So we have Hopping term, Hopping, let's say we have interaction term U, and we have a chemical potential. And this model was introduced in 1963 by Hubbard and Kutzwiller and others. And they noticed that there is a metal insulator transition with half filling in this model. So when, on the average, each lattice side is occupied by one electron, the chemical potential is equal to zero. And that's where we normalize the chemical potential. And as you know, there are these pictures that you can finding this sort of works, namely if you have small interaction, the local density states and the omega, something like so. So this is for U much less than the bandwidth W. But for sufficiently large, U much larger than W, you get two well separated spectral regions. If the chemical potential is zero, which is here, then we have half-filled band here, the usual situation, solid state, and here we have a completely filled so-called lower Hubbard band. We have an excitation gap here, delta E, for charge excitations. So it's an insulator. And from this picture, you would guess that this gap closes for U values of the order of W. But there were, in the beginnings in the 60s, there were some problems with this picture here, because this, of course, is motivated by an atomic picture. In the strictly atomic limit, you have two energy levels here and here, and then you switch on the hopping, and then you broaden these energy levels. So you have all K states in here, represented in here. So in the original approximation, the Hubbard 1, or in later Hubbard approximations, the thermoliquid requirements were not met. And this was a problem, and there was a lot of discussion in the literature at the time. And a solution to this came when dynamical mean field theory was proposed and actually carried out. So, you know, this theory where you map the system onto a quantum impurity problem. Proposed first by Metzner and Vollhardt, and then used by many people, especially Cotillard and his collaborators. There was a very nice Physics Today article last year on the status of this. Okay, so there's a mapping on to a quantum impurity problem which involves one single site, but therefore swim correlations cannot be taken into account in this first step. So what one likes to do is to consider the totally swim thrust rate situation. Forget about the possibility of anti-ferromagnetic order. So where one always has a paramagnetic state. And then these equations can be solved with various techniques, first the quantum Monte Carlo and later other techniques, numerical randomization group and so on. And what one finds is that the picture is, of course, roughly as it is sketched up here, except that in this picture, there is a little detail, and if a small u, you get something like this. For larger u, you get the situation which is u, namely you get a resonance peak in the density of states at zero. And this value here is always fixed in this theory. And of course, at large, we get the separated bands. So there is this new thing that there is a resonance appearing here, which is, of course, since we are dealing with the quantum impurity model, which is, of course, a Kondo resonance. And what happens when one approaches the metal insulator transition is that the weight under this resonance goes to zero. Okay, and then you see that you get immediately a gap. You get the first order transition. This first order transition has been mapped out very precisely, and in a phase diagram of temperature versus U, it looks like so. Starting from small U, we have the metal. At large U, we have the insulator. The metallic solution in the DMFT equations is stable up to a certain point, UC2. The insulating solution is stable down to a certain point, UC1. We have a region where both solutions exist, and that's where the first order transition appears. First order transition at T equals 0 is at UC2, and one goes up here, and it goes to smaller, somewhat smaller U's, and it ends at the critical point here. So we really have like UC and TC. So there's a first order transition from metal to insulator here in this theory. And above this critical point, we have a crossover.
Yeah, and I was very confused at this point. So your band pictures, I mean, that's a zero temperature property. Okay, so I understand what's going on the T equals zero axis.
Uh-huh.
And now, how should I think about a transition at finite temperature? I get my
qualitative
function, then I get everything gets smeared out. Why is that always conducting at finite temperature?
First order.
It's a first order transition because you have this situation here. You get this situation here. Even at finite temperature, you have a situation where the weight under this peak will go to zero at a certain U, and at this point, plop, you get a finite
temperature. What sense does this picture even make at finite and non-zero temperature? I mean, isn't that the zero temperature concept?
No. That's the local spectral function here, and that's defined at finite temperature as well.
Oh, okay. So that remains true and not
zero. Yeah, it remains true at finite temperature. Okay, yeah. So much for zero doping. Now, what about finite doping? Let's call delta the doping, and delta is 1 minus L of N. Okay. There are not very many papers on that, but one remarkable paper is by Fischer, Kotler, and Müller. In 95, they were able to show in strong coupling perturbation theory, even analytically, that when you have a situation at large U, you dope the system, then states are created in the gap. It's not like you would expect in the simple Hubbard picture that you just move down here to the upper edge of the lower Hubbard band, but states are created in the gap. For whole doping, they are created a little bit above the lower Hubbard band. And this is worked out, and the width of this is roughly, this is a fraction, it's a fraction of the bandwidth here, this distance here, and it's, even for infinitely large U, they'll say, they will always give these states. And now you and see if the following will happen, that when the voltages in the insulating state will be stable, then we will be meta stable, change the potential potential to here, I mean, and only when you hit this point, the upper edge of the lower Hubbard band, which you had at half filling, the insulating state will be totally unstable. So we have a situation where we have instability.
So excuse me, this extra lobe appears even without doping? I'm a little confused.
Well, this thing, with doping, with doping. This is with doping. This is this you create when you dope.
And then when you dope, where does the chemical, where does the Fermi energy go when you dope then?
Oh, it moves down here.
To the it gap moves down between here. The two,
well, it moves on. Well, there's not necessarily a gap that could be filled. I mean, this is depends on. Yeah. Well, we'll move down here, and it's just a question: what happens with the two states? You can have an insulating state, and you can have a metallic state. The insulating state will be totally unstable. When the chemical potential moves below the upper edge of the lower Hubbard band.
What about the upper edge? We need to chemical potential in the small peak to the thing close to the mechanical. Why is it forbidden? If it would just cut, there's
not
having the spectral potential.
Well, no, it's not forbidden. I'm just discussing the stability now. It could be that the insulator will just stay on when you move the chemical potential. We're now discussing chemical potential, not doping, but shifting the chemical potential. That's a very important point. We'll come later to the dependence on the doping. Now we are discussing the dependence on the chemical potential.
I guess the question that they're all curious about is how much spectral weight is in that little lobe? Is it proportional to the number of doped?
It's proportional to the number. That's right. Okay, so the insulating state is unstable for mu equals this point. Okay, let me now introduce some rotation here. Let me call the energy of the upper Hubbard band energy E plus EH plus. And let me call this thing here, like they did, mu c minus, because there's of course another one up here when we talk the valid ones. So the insulating state will be unstable when you get here, and the metallic state will be unstable when you come up here and you reach this point here. So you have a situation where you have overlapping regions in chemical potential where two solutions are stable. Okay.
So and this, what do you mean by two solutions are stable? I mean, in the sense of a free energy, you can get only one global minimum, right? Or are they degenerate minimum?
No, wait, you can discuss, of course you have to discuss now the free energies, and you have to discuss whether you get a first order transition and so on. That's a different thing, but you can just discuss the stability of a solution first, and the solution can be stable even though the free energy is higher than the free energy of some other thing.
So we're just talking about the local minimum.
Free energy. Yeah. And this matches now nicely with this here, with this situation, namely what these two energies are is nothing but UC2 is this UC minus here, and the UC1 is the EH plus. Yeah. Now we can continue this picture here to finite mu, so let's add another axis, mu, which continues to negative mu here. Okay? This edge of the lower Hubbard band, it moves as minus u over 2, probably plus d, d is the half bandwidth, something like this for large u. So we can now map this out. So it's we have some curve here which shows somewhere here. And we can just sketch this now. This is now an artistic sketch. So this would be this line which merges into EH plus. And this point here, I want to connect with mu c minus. So this will be something like this. Okay? And now, from here, from these points here on, you have, again, these phase separation lines, you know, starting up to finite temperature. And so what you get is a surface of first order phase transitions in this picture.
So this is all done assuming there is no magnetic order.
Yeah. That's just everything is in the spin frustrating model. But if we have magnetic order, then it of course depends a little bit on the details, on the band structure and so on. We could we have some magnetic region here, anti-ferromagnetic region, and this first order transition may actually come up out of this anti-ferromagnetic region. But let's just, for the sake of definiteness, discuss completely frustrated situation. Okay, now this has been studied with EMFT, and there is a paper by Cochlear and co-workers in 2002, and we have done some work on that recently. That's Theo Kosti and Achim Roche, Matthias Wojtal, myself. And it turns out that this is what you get. So calculations have been done at not too large U, so in this regime here. And so what you find now is, if you now consider this for fixed U in the T mu plane, then of course you get something like this. If so down T as a function of mu, if U is between the this U C here and U C 2, so in this regime here, it is true. And you cut through here, you get a intersection here at finite t. So you get something like this. It's a first order phase separation line which aims at the critical point here. And if you do the same at larger u, so u larger than u c2, then you get something like this. You need probably minus mu here. You need a finite mu here to get to this point then. So you're up here, you need a finite mu to get here. And then you have this version
here. Which is an insulator and a metal, so the insulator is below and to the right.
Or? Yeah, so the metal, it's here in the insulator, here. Yeah, that's always metal. Okay, now it would be nice to convert this into...
If you look at this actual spectrum, I mean, what do you actually calculate to get this curves? You calculate, you don't calculate the conductivity, you calculate the spectrum.
What we calculated was the spectral function.
So
we see, what happens, you see a jump in the spectral function. You see a jump of
the peak in the spectral function. So what happens if there are some when you're away from half-wave? Is it still fixed? It's always the same? The top of the combo resonance is fixed?
No, no longer fixed. No. It's like Kondo. Think of Kondo. Only if you have a symmetric Anderson model, it sticks. If you move the
peak. In the Kondo model, if you're away, it still sticks because you have some charge and balance.
No, but it depends on.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Sure. No, so it jumps, actually. The peak jumps. And maybe I can show it later. Okay, so what in the end what comes out now? Of course, you have to find the relation between delta, the doping, and the chemical potential. And for the metal, that's easy because they are just continuously connected. For the internet, it's not so clear what we find is in the front. It's that delta is a function of mu in the regime where you have this middle regime, you have for a range of mu delta equal to zero, then you jump, you go into the metal, you come down, you get the hysteresis here. And if you now translate this into the key delta plane, this is the plane that we considered over here, the delta plane, then what will happen is that you get for, in this case here, so for uc less than uc2, you get a certain solution of first order transitions ending in a critical point, and for mu larger than uc2, this will always start at zero and go something like this. Now the question is why hasn't that been seen? First of all, of course, you need to have the right values of mu. This is a very narrow range of mu, so that would be unlikely to hit it in some material. This, of course, is a large range of mu, and that's probably the range that's realized in ITC. The question is, what is this? What are the numbers here? And the number here, over here, this TC here, which sets the temperature scale here, is not so low. It's in these calculations is 0.025 W, so it's 250 Kelvin. It's in this range. So this is the temperature. Now, of course, we have not really mapped out this dependence. So if this does not drop too steeply, then you would expect that this temperature would be of the order of, say, 100, 200.
On the first one, if you put delta or T as the y-axis.
Yeah.
The first one.
Here?
Yeah, it's delta.
This is delta versus mu. Delta versus mu, yeah. Okay, and the other question is, so this is roughly 100 to 200 K. What about the critical doping? We have found first order solution only for very small doping, less than 1%. Which means that in this regime, we have, of course, the antiferromagnetic state. And so you would maybe you could expect that what you would find is that this thing here, of course, in this slot, it would be very, very steep up here. Maybe it would stick out here. You would be able to see a little bit up here. Okay. I'm not sure anybody has looked for such a thing. Okay. There are also questions of doping. We found that we cannot get all dopings we want. There are some regions which are forbidden. But there are no solutions simply. Some regions that are excluded. So this is not simply a coexistence regime, but it could also be that some of these, part of this diagram is simply not accessible. But anyway, I think it's
that would mean then phase separation, or what would it mean experimentally if you say it's not accessible?
Yeah. It's not. Yeah. It's what. Yeah. Maybe more than that. It may, but that has may have to do with the equation. It may not have to do with the physics. I mean, that's another thing. Because phase separation, you would get anyway. If you have a coexistence region, you would have a coexistence of insulating and metallic catches.
But the insulating is more higher temperature.
Yeah, the insulating is the one at higher temperature. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So the metal. So at T equals zero, you have always metal. For any doping, you get always metal at T equals zero, and only at higher doping you get insulating. At higher temperatures. That's right. Okay.
Except if the delta equals zero. If the delta equals zero, you would have insulation.
Of course, no. But what I want to say is if you dope at T equals zero, you always get a metal.
Okay. The more it goes, the conductivity goes way down when you go through this first order phase transition because it becomes a.
Yeah. Right. It does, yeah. It would, yeah. It would. No, certainly, I mean, that would be observable, yeah.
But is there a simple physical argument following that you understand this? I mean, you said you didn't count the conductivity, just the density of states, basically.
Right.
And so this picture is that you start at a metal phase, you heat up the system, and all of a sudden you open up a gap in the density of states.
That's a simple picture.
Is there a qualitative argument why that actually happens? I mean, what drives basically the opening up of the gap? So it's basically in this language that one supports the Coulomb effect?
It's basically, well, no, it has to do with the fact that these curves are going backwards. I mean, right, that's the point. So that if you go to finite temperature, you find that you need less U to cross the line from metal to insulator. So temperature favors the insulator. As you can see right here.
No, I agree, but the question is, I mean, what is kind of the physics behind this? Is there any headwind argument?
I'm not aware of any qualitative argument, but certainly, yeah.
Sure, so you're saying that zero there, there is convergence, which is temperature dependent and gradually goes down.
Yeah.
But for any finite doping, it goes in.
Yeah.
I mean.
No. You have to. No. We are starting now from this picture, for instance, where we have a gap, and then we move the chemical potential down here. And then you get the first order transition to the finite temperature. In this region, but it's not related to this convergence. Okay, so this is the first part, and I almost used my time, so I have to move more quickly now. I think so much for this little side effect. It's kind of, I mean, the way we got to think about this was that we thought, in this picture here, say here, up here, we have a metal insulator transition here at half filling. That's a first order transition. The first order transition cannot just sit here as a point. That's very improbable. And then you go out to finite delta. That can't be. So there must be some continuation, must do something. That was our sort of beginning, and then we thought about it, and we did these calculations, and so on. Okay, now let me come to the next part, to the, where we have a lot more results, incoherent metal phase. So there, as I said, we would like to start with the TJ model. So map the Hubbard model onto the QK model in the low energy sector. So let me write down the QJ model. We have the Hopping term. We have the exchange interaction term. The potential. And we have from the projection onto the low energy sector an infinitely strong repulsion or UP. So this will take to infinity, and this will prevent a double occupancy of. So we have a situation where we've constrained hopping and we have the exchange interaction here. We want to apply dynamical mean field theory to this model in a straightforward way, as it's done for the Hubbard model. We would get a quantum impurity where we have hopping of electrons from the medium onto the impurity side. And here, we would find that this interaction is really in field approximation, if we just do the usual procedure. And that's not good enough. So what we do is we use the so-called extended dynamical mean field theory. Which was first proposed for Anderson model and Kondo lattice model by Pajuta and Kotlia, and has been used extensively by GDLC for describing the quantum phase transition, the anti-ferromagnet. And then what do you do there? When you do the following, you go to infinite dimensions and you scale P with square root of P, and you scale J with the same vector. It's also a nearest neighbor interaction, so you can do the same thing, and then you get a model where you have both the effect of the hopping and the effect of the exchange interaction on the quantum level. So you can capture the quantum fluctuations, the local quantum fluctuations of the spin in this way. So in the end, you map onto an effective impurity model. Which I have to write down. So a impurity is given by a fermionic bath, which is a sigma, some energy, unknown energies, Ek, Ck, sigma beta, Ck, sigma, unprojected Cs, hopping onto the impurity. Sum over k sigma d k sigma theta d sigma d are the operators for electrons on the impurity minus mu in d plus up the positive interaction doing the projection n d up and d down. Okay, so that's the fermionic part, and then we have a bosonic part. Sum over q energies, omega q, Bose operators, h, q, better we need a three-component vector of bosons to describe the spin field, h, q, better h, q, plus coupling of the local spin with the boson field, s dot h, q, plus h, q, whatever. So that's the model. And this model you can derive rigorously in the limit of infinite dimensions. The special point about it is that in this limit, you find that the two baths, the fermionic bath and the bosonic bath, are decoupled. Because infinitely many degrees of freedom to couple two, so they are decoupled. Of course, in finite dimensions, you know that they are actually coupled. They know of each other. But the approximation is now to neglect this effect and to work with this infinity model. This model then, of course, will give set of energies which are momentum independent. So, sigma for the, as usual, for the single particle. So, sigma k omega will be approximated by sigma of omega, and we have a self energy for the spin propagator, which we call n. Nq and omega will be approximated by n of omega, and this is exactly in infinite dimensions, but in finite dimensions, two dimensions, which we would, of course, we want to do the calculation in two dimensions. This is what that is. Yeah.
So the spin operators in the first law, they are just C-C combinations. Okay?
Yeah.
The spins of
that's
the
right.
Guys
that's
and
right.
The
that's right. With this spin.
No, but
here.
Yeah, up
yeah.
Here.
Yeah.
But down there, they are completely. So there is nothing to do with the.
No, this thing. Okay, sorry, I should have said no. This thing, this S, is of course T dagger T.
Yeah, so they are unrelated to C's anymore.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That's why we introduce this other part. So we divide the medium up into two parts, into a fermionic part and a bosonic part. Fermionic part is responsible for the hopping, bosonic part is responsible for the exchange interaction. And I mean, if this would not be exact in infinite dimensions, then I think a lot of people would say that's a strange approximation. But it's the same logic that leads you to the DMFT, usual DMFT. You can now argue about whether such a theory is good in two dimensions. But we can just look what we get. I mean, we can just do a calculation and then look what we get.
But again, we lost all the intersect vibrations. Because we have the Hamiltonian.
The only thing we have is local spin fluctuations. So the coupling of the spin of the local of the impurity spin with the surrounding spins is taken into account in an average way, but in a quantum, world, we have quantum fluctuations. Okay, so we would, as I said, we would like to use this model now in two dimensions. So we will use the bare band structure of the corresponding model, and the tight binding model in two dimensions, which is to say that the bare energy, epsilon k, the band energy, is just minus dt cosine kx plus cosine ky, and the bare exchange coupling is 2j cosine qx plus cosine. Right? Which means that the density of states for epsilon and for j have discontinuities at the vanish, which is very important because it will, as far as j is concerned, this will destroy magnetic order, the finite temperature. So we will not find, with this density of states, we will not find magnetic order, finite temperature, which is good. Two dimensions.
The sub-energies, these are the sub-energies that arise from the interaction between the fermions and the bosons, or the sub-energies that arise from the interaction of the fermions with the localized...
Wait, these are the sub-energies for the single particle Green's functions and for the spin Green's function. I'll write it down here. Okay, so now we need the Bath Green's functions. We have one for GC, which is combined with the hopping into one quantity, V squared sum over K, 1 over omega minus EK, and the one for the H bosons, sum over Q, 2 omega q over omega squared minus omega q squared, and I again include the coupling I squared here. So these are the only quantities that we need for the infinity model. So we don't need the energies ek and omega q separately, or the couplings v and I, they are not resolved. We only need these functions here. Okay, so these functions we have to calculate self-consistently. And how is this done? Well, we have, first of all, for the impurity Green's function, which is defined in the usual way as the expectation value of B operators. So I have time for the product B sigma of tau B sigma beta of 0. So this thing is given by 1 over omega minus mu minus Bath Green's function C of omega, and now we get this advantage, minus sigma.
Now we are saying that this self-energy coincides with self-energy of
the lattice forming.
In the local, that's what we're just going to prove.
And this, and the similar thing can be defined for the spins. So spins, now let me abbreviate this as alpha, component alpha, omega. So this object, this is 1 over m of omega, which is the spin self energy, minus gh of omega. So these are the two impurity things, and now we have to close the self-consistency loop. One can show that in infinite dimensions that the two self-energies are identical, the one for the impurity problem and the one for the lattice problem. And this is what we use again. Okay. So GC and GH, these Bath Green's functions, have to be determined self-consistently. And this is done by requiring that the impurity Green's function G-impurity is equal to the local part of the lattice Green's function, which is the sum over k of the lattice Green's function omega minus epsilon k minus omega. And the same equation, similar equation for pi, pi purity, this would be equal to pi local omega, which is sum over q, 1 over exchange coupling jq plus self energy j. Okay, so what is now needs to be done is to solve the impurity problem, feed the results into this equation here, and iterate until the set consistent solution is found. Now,
so, sorry, Peter, the sigma and the omega, you basically determine from that requirement that you just stated?
Yeah.
Okay, so you don't calculate sigma or omega or m diagrammatically?
Yeah.
You do not?
No.
Okay.
No, it's all determined. Yeah. Everything is determined now by the set consistency group. Okay, and now the big problem is, of course, how to solve the impurity problem. Because this impurity problem is not so easy. I mean, it's the usual impurity problem in TMFT is also not easy. There is no standard method to solve it. And there are, of course, quantum Monte Carlo, there is numerical normalization group, there is renormalized perturbation theory, there are slave bosons, and so on. But all of these methods have some weak points, and some of the parameter regimes are not well covered by this. Okay. But in this case, it's even worse, because here we have these bosons here. And most methods do not know how to read bosons, like quantum Monte Carlo, for instance. This cannot be used. Numerical realization group cannot be used. At least it has not been developed yet. I mean, there are some, we have some ideas how to do it. So what we do is we use the renormalized perturbation theory, and this goes under the name there's NCA, non-crossing approximation. Okay, so solution of the theory problem. And it turns out that in this case, the NCA is actually very lucky, and the usual problem that arises when you apply NCA to the solution of DMFT equations, that doesn't arise here, for a reason I'll describe shortly. So what do we do? We have to deal with a spin operator that we do in the usual way by pseudoparticles. That's a small side that's well known now. Okay, so how to do this pseudoparticle representation of the projected operator d sigma. It's projected because we have the infinite Coulomb repulsion on the side, so we write this as d dagger f sigma, where f's are pseudo fermions and d's are pseudo bosons, slave bosons. And for S, we then get the fermionic representation, 1 half F sigma dagger tau Pauli matrices sigma sigma prime F sigma prime. Okay, so this is our representation. Now this is only true if we apply the constraint, namely that the charge Q, which is the total occupation number V beta D plus sum over sigma F sigma beta F sigma is equal to 1. And this we do by using the old trick first introduced by Abrikosov. And we add a Lagrange multiplier term to the Hamiltonian plus lambda q, and we take the limit lambda going to infinity. And this can be done in a nice way, and it's an exact thing. Okay, and what do we do with the dynamics? We use a conserving approximation.
You want lambda times 2 minus 1 or something. Is that right?
What?
You want lambda times
2
minus 1 or something.
Yeah, that doesn't matter, because this is just a factor that cancels out. It's you don't have to. Yeah. Okay, conserving approximation, why? Because we need to conserve the relations of the self-energies of the different particles. Now we have to introduce self-energies for the fermions, for the bosons, for the C particles, for all these particles. And they have to be sort of matched. You cannot just use approximations for each of these, some approximations, but they have to be matched. And that's the idea of conserving approximations. So we start with a functional, phi. This is a functional of all these green functions, gf, gb, gc, gh, so on. And the self energies are then just obtained by functional differentiation of the functional with respect to the string function. So sigma x is delta phi delta g x, and so on. And the only thing that remains now is to specify phi. And this we do in the simplest possible way by using a extended or something called generalized NCA non-crossing approximation. This is nothing else but a second order perturbation theory, second order self-consistent perturbation theory. So the phi is given by the first diagram, which involves the hopping. So this is this diagram. Now, just do this. Little vertex V, and another V over here. We have conduction electron line here. We have a Barth line that we can see with the boson, we have the fermion here. Then we have another second order diagram involving the exchange. The interaction of the spin with the bath, with the bosonic bath, and this is this guy. So we have an H here, and we have a bubble of S here. Okay. So the idea of this approximation is that if these couplings V and I are small, then the second order curve should be okay. And it's known to work quite well for the single impurity Anderson model. Yeah. Through TK, it violates the Fermi liquid properties at low temperatures. We understand very well why, but that's another question. But in the lattice, when this method, this non-crossing approximation, the usual one, without this term, is applied to the solution of the DNFP equations, there is a big problem, because the NCA does not respect the sum rule, the exact property of a local spectral function, and that its value at omega equals 0 is exactly fixed. Okay, and it overshoots by 10%, 10 to 20%, and that causes, when you feed it into the self-consistency loop, that causes catastrophe. Namely, you get negative circle weight and everything breaks down. And that happens already at TK for the DNFP equation. Now here, it doesn't happen because we have this extra term. And this extra term broadens the peak, the condo peak. And it actually turns out that this term for low doping destroys the condo peak completely. So we never have a problem of this type, and everything is well behaved, and it works quite well. Okay, now I would like to show you some results of this calculation. Is it on now? Yeah. Well, yeah, I think okay. So this is now the result of the local spectral function. At low temperature, it's 0.06 is certainly low temperature. It's, you can go a little lower, but not too much. And at there is not open, 1% open. And here the result is shown as a function of j, different j. So for j equals 0, you see this curve here, and it has a peak here, so-called quasi-particle peak, just like you find in usual DMFT calculations. If you now increase j up to 0.3, which is about the right value for the Cooke rates, you find that this peak is totally suppressed, and you end up with a pseudo-gap here. Very nice pseudo-gap of width j's. Now we can do the same for fixed j, 0.3, as a function of doping. And start out with large doping, 24% here, that's the highest curve. You get this peak, this thermoelectric type peak, and as the doping is decreased, this peak disappears, and you start to form the this is a plot of the spectral functions, A of k and omega, where the k dependence is sort of trivial. It only comes from epsilon k, from the non-interacting energy here. But you can see this is at 30%, and this is a quarter of the Brillouin zone. And here you see the non-interacting Fermi surface, and you see that the spectral wave is nicely located here, as you would expect it for a Fermi liquid. Some renormalization here of the effective mass. If you go to 10%, this spectral wave is moving away from where the Fermi surface is for a Fermi liquid. That's a very clear indication of violation of Fermi liquid properties. Also, you have very, very broad spectral wave here, distribution here. And at 2%, the spectral wave has moved out to the corner of the Brillouin zone. We can understand that by looking at the effective chemical potential here. U minus real part of sigma at zero frequency. This is the quantity which tells you about the location of the Fermi surface. And if this system would be a Fermi liquid, then this quantity should be down here, where you see the line here indicated. And that's the case for a large doping. Nicely the case here. But as you decrease the doping, this effective chemical potential moves away, and it moves up all the way to the upper edge of the Hubbard band. So the Luttinger theorem is strongly violated. And you can also see that in the C factor and in the imaginary part of sigma here, which is not Fermi liquid like at all.
What's the significance of the sign change of the effective
chemical
potential?
Here?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, because you are below half filling. If you are below half filling, then the chemical potential should be negative. In this.
As you go to the equilibrium metal, appears to become positive.
Yeah, I mean, the point is that it should be in the middle of the lower Hubbard band, and it moves up to the upper edge of the lower Hubbard band, and that's inconsistent with Luttinger liquid, because that tells you that all states are involved. Whereas in the Luttinger liquid, we have a Fermi body, which involves only the k-states of the lower part of the Hubbard band. Okay. So, the spin excitation spectrum, the local spin excitation spectrum in the single light approximation doesn't show a gap, but the Q-dependent spin spectra show the gap clearly. Here's Q equals 0, and here we go along the diagonal, here's 0.2 pi pi, and so on. And only when we get up to pi pi directly, we get this huge peak here, and in the summation over Q, this huge peak basically preempts all the gap structures here. That's a, as we know, it's an artifact of the single cycle approximation. Here you see the entropy.
Just to calculate this asymptotic bubble using the normalized Green's functions. Yeah. That's sure.
Yeah, that's right. Uh-huh. It's, but there's no choice in this scheme. It's given. When I have chosen the generalized, the generating functional, I have no choice anymore. Everything is given.
What you just showed was the acuity susceptibility or the susceptibility?
The local susceptibility and the Q-dependent susceptibility. Let me go back. So this is the local susceptibility. That's the one that you would measure at one point. You would do.
Which is the same as the impurity susceptibility.
That's yeah. And this one is the Q-dependent susceptibility over here. The one you would measure in your neutron scattering.
Right. Can you calculate this from the bubble again?
Yes.
Or?
Yeah. That's given by the pseudo-Feynman bubble in this approximation.
So you don't just...
Not the pseudo-Feynman. Calculate the Green's function.
No. That's given by the pseudo-Fermion bubble. Because what you have to do is you have to take the generating functional and you differentiate it with respect to the field H. And that will give you, it's a magnetic field, and that will give you the susceptibility.
How is Q coming?
A Q comes in from over here. Chi of, where did we say it?
There's the
edge.
I mean, this is just 1 over
jq
plus
n. It's 1 over jq plus n, yeah. 1 over jq plus n. Right.
So it's 1?
Yeah, that's the, yeah, right. Okay. So this is entropy, and here we compare with exact diagonalization and also with experiment. So what it's roughly consistent with exact diagonalization, except for very small delta, where we do not get the decrease here of the entropy that comes from the already forming magnetic order. And, well, yeah, roughly 600 or beta R in the same ballpark. This is transport now, so we have the resistivity over here, it's scaled. It's multiplied by delta to bring out the scaling. It should be proportional to 1 over delta. And that's shown here. So these curves cluster up here. So it's linear. It's higher temperatures. There's some artifact here, which has to do with too strong damping in this theory, in the single side theory. And here you see the decrease of the resistivity caused by the pseudo gap. And the Hall coefficient is plotted here. You see for high dopings, this is the red curve here. The Hall coefficient as a function of temperature is negative at low temperatures, as it should be, electron-like. As you increase temperature, it crosses over, it becomes positive, whereas at small doping, it's positive all the way, and it starts to grow rapidly with lowering the temperature here for small dopings. If you take a cut here at some low temperature and plot our H as a function of delta, you see those is 1 over delta. And that's consistent with studies of a single hole in the Heisenberg model. Here you have some comparison with experiment, you see that these curves turn upward. We don't get this leveling off here at lower temperatures. Okay, now, Let me just, maybe 5 minutes? Okay, good. So we also did calculations using the dynamical cluster approximation. Why? Of course, it's known that in the cuprates, the self-energy is not only frequency dependent, it has a very prominent momentum dependence. The gap is different along the diagonal, along 0, pi, and so on. This effect we want to capture, of course. And this can be captured in an extension of this theory to a cluster where we look in one single side, we look at the cluster. The best we can do so far is 2x2. But 2x2 is already not so bad because it already has this feature of distinguishing between diagonal and parallel to the axis behavior. So we did this. There are two variants of this. We used the dynamical cluster approximation, which is based on a subdivision of the Brillouin zone in four parts. Within each part, the momentum dependence is neglected. So we have basically three, because two of them are equal, three self-energies. So sigma 0, 0, sigma pi, pi, sigma 0, pi. And for these, we have to solve the equation. The result is here.
This is different from what Kotlier does because they use different, cosx plus cosy. Yeah.
The method, the other, the real space cluster method is better in the sense that it does give you a continuous momentum dependence.
Right.
It's of course much better. It has some other problems, but the main problem is it's much harder to implement. That's why we chose the DCA for a start. That's maybe something for the future.
This is the Jarrell type approximation.
That's the right. Okay, so here you see local spectral functions for different concentrations, 6%, 12, 18, and 24. And here's a comparison of the first calculation that I showed you. Now in blue is the four-side cluster calculation, and in black is an exact diagonalization study for 16 sites. And it's interesting that this blue curve, so the improved calculation, is in much nicer agreement with the exact diagonalization sites. So the sequence here at the low dopings, this peak that is present in the exact diagonalization, that's captured nicely, that wasn't there so prominently in the single site. And somewhat similar here, and here there is also some agreement here at high dopings. Doesn't work so well, I don't know why. But we need to do some more work. These are unpublished results so far. So this is now a result for the k-dependent spectral function for the three k's that we have, 0, 0, 0, pi, and pi, pi. And you see now that the shapes of these peaks are quite different from different k's as you would get. So they're not just shifted as you would get in the EDMFT calculation, but just get shifted peaks. Here we have a very narrow peak, 0 pi, because that's close to the Fermi surface. Peaks get narrow, gets narrower, and we have broader peaks when we go away. This is a sketch of a Fermi surface, very provisional, sort of not the last word, 5% and 10%. And this is now the local spin excitation spectrum, and you see now we get a pseudogap. We didn't get a pseudogap in the single side approximation, but now we get nicely the pseudogap here. This is at the lowest concentration of this pseudogap here. This is for 1q, for pi 0, the temperature dependence. And it was done the electrical resistivity again. And you see that this feature that we had, namely this turning up at the higher concentration, that disappeared. Now we get actually too much of turning down here at the lower temperatures. So that needs also some improvement. Of course, these transport calculations, they get more complicated because if you have a cluster, you get various directions. And this is done in a sort of with additional approximations. This is not a whole thing yet. Okay, yeah. That's, I think, all for the results now.
The transport, you just evaluate Google Bubble with that.
You can make use of the infinite dimension limit, and then you see that the transport is given by the bubble for the resistivity, a cubed, I mean the spectral function cubed for the Hall coefficient and so on. Right. Good, that's all for the results. Let me now mention, very importantly, who did all this. And that's mainly Christian Haule, my former PhD student, who did a marvelous job here in implementing all this. And he will, he's in from Slovenia, from Ljubljana, and he will join the faculty at Rutgers in the summer. And then a lot of input came from Achim Rosch in the interpretation of the results, and from Hans Bohr as well. Okay, that's all, thank you.
In these complex calculations, what is your physical picture for the pseudogap?
Yeah. The physical picture, I think, would be that you do not need anti-ferromagnetic patches or something to get the pseudogap. Yes. But you only need local tendency towards singlet formation. So you need this tendency that the local spin has a tendency to orient the neighboring spins in the antiferal way, and that will cause that's enough to give you a pseudogap. That's as much as we can read off these results. Which is to say that we don't need, from this, you would say we don't need antiferromagnetic fluctuations or some other longer range fluctuations, but it's enough to have something like a spin singlet phase, I don't know, RVB or whatever, that would be enough to give you pseudogap. So in some sense, it's unexpected to get a pseudogap in this local calculation. You would say you need, for the usual picture, you would need the larger areas where the gap forms and where you can then get that the antiferromagnetic gap forms.
So the second question I have is if you were using parameters near, let's say, the oxides,
yeah,
would you be getting pseudogap values quite easily at the kind that are measured?
If
the scale
for realistic, yeah. All these parameters were taken from the Cooper experiment.
And then you get realistic values.
Yeah,
pseudogaps.
You get the pseudogap for dopings, which are about right. I mean, it's about.
And the scale of it is also right.
Scale of it is right. Yeah. Also, the scale. Of course, you can look at the temperature again as in the phase side and the regime where you get the pseudogap. Here, this. What is the temperature out here? That's right, it comes out.
Okay, and then the last question I have is in your spectral density, the A for the electron,
uh-huh,
as you pseudogap forms, where is the spectral wave coming from?
It's redistributed over the whole
lower
half of the space. There's a little bit, I mean, you could see from this, let me just sketch it again. So we have the lower half of the band here, and we have twisting usually in the thermodynamic state, and now what we get is this and this. So we get a little bit of enhancement here, which may not quite compensate for the loss of spectral weight here, but the rest is just shifted over there.
But it's a large influence on the whole singularity because you do need a dimension fluctuations, really.
Yeah.
So this vector involves similarities.
Yeah.
Because you use actual two-dimensional
Neighbor
hopping dispersion.
Yeah, okay.
So it's not just
but finite doping, I wouldn't, there's not too much of this. I mean, this is, this would play a role if you had a much larger cluster, which could map these von Hoff similarities in the cluster itself. But that we are far away from this limit. So far, this is not. I don't think it, what is important is but we can use instead of this tight binding density of states, we could use some other 3D density of states for this calculation. That doesn't matter too much, but for the spin part matters a lot, because if you don't use the density of states for JQ, which has a discontinuity, we do not suppress magnetic order, and we get magnetically ordered states. The temperatures of, comparable with here, with the supergroup. Okay. That's for me. That's important. In that sense, two-dimensionality is very important.
So then Neumann-Wagner would be validated in this case, or?
No, then you would be in three dimensions.
Yeah.
Let's say,
yeah.
That's,
A related question. What you presented at the end, so this extended dynamical crystal approximation, is there a way to take the inter-side tracking into account, one sense? You agree with that? The J inter-side?
Sure.
So better included.
Of course. No, that's of course
it's
a point.
The second point is, don't you think that you could do the same, I don't know, just an idea, using, introducing a method of RPA approximation in addition to the DMFT? Maybe it's very rough, but do you think it makes sense to try to...
The point is, I think the charm of DMFT is that it becomes exact in infinite dimensions. So there is it has a certain quality of consistency, a consistent theory. If I add something like that, thought about this as well, then you lose this property and it's more...
The last question is, since you are probably experience with first approximation, this first order transition and this UC1, UC2, this coexistence of the two phase, is it still there when you include the first approximation, or is it something which is a kind of artifact of the DMFT?
No, I think it's still there. As far as I recall, it's still there. Yeah. It's a robust, the first order transition is a robust feature.
Can the auxiliary gap be suppressed by application of magnetic field, or there is not?
I'm sure it will. I'm sure a strong enough magnetic field will suppress the gap, I'm sure. Yeah. Because as we see it, the gap is coming from these antiferromagnetic fluctuations. Fluctuations are suppressed. Okay,
and we need to restoration of thermal equilibrium
that it is. That could be. The point is that in DMFT calculations, you see at higher temperatures, you see a behavior that's somewhat similar to what we get here. Namely, the effective chemical potential is also up there, not where it should be. But when you go to lower temperatures, the effective chemical potential comes down. And it agrees with the Fermi liquid value eventually. So in DMFT, you get a Fermi liquid.
Okay, at that point, I think a number of people have decided that an hour and a half is enough. So I think Peter will be around for several more weeks, right? So there'll be plenty of opportunity to talk to Peter. So let's thank him once again.